could forgive her the jelly business, he supposed. What he could not forgive, in spite of his attraction to Susan, was that awful smile on Olive Thorin's face as she watched the girl sitting in what should have been her place. Sitting in her place and laughing. These were the things that chased through his head as he paced off acres of moonlight. He had no business with such thoughts. Susan Delgado was not the reason he was here, nor was the ridiculous knuckle-cracking mayor and his pitiable country Mary of a wife. Yet he couldn't put them away and get to what was his business. He had forgotten the face of his father, and walked in the moonlight, hoping to find it again. In such fashion he came along the sleeping, silver-gilded High Street, walking north to south, thinking vaguely that he would perhaps stand Cuthbert and Aland to a taste of something wet, and toss the dice down Satan's Alley a time or two before going back to get Rusher and call it a night. And so it was that he happened to spy Jonas, the man's gaunt figure and fall of long white hair were impossible to mistake, standing outside the bat wings of the Traveler's Rest and peering in. Jonas did this with one hand on the butt of his gun and a tense set of body that put everything else from Roland's mind at once. Something was going on, and if Bert and Alain were in there, it might involve them. They were the strangers in town, after all, and it was possible, even likely, that not everyone in Hambury loved the affiliation with the fervor that had been professed at tonight's dinner. Or perhaps it was Jonas's friends who were in trouble. Something was brewing in any case. With no clear thought as to why he was doing it, Roland went softly up the steps to the mercantile's porch. There was a line of carved animals there, and probably spiked firmly to the boards, so that drunken wags from the saloon across the street couldn't carry them away, chanting the nursery rhymes of their childhood as they went. Roland stepped behind the last one in line, it was the bear, and bent his knees so that the crown of his hat wouldn't show. Then he went as still as the carving. He could see Jonas turn, look across the street, then look to his left, peering at something. Very low, a sound.
Wow, wow.
It's a cat in the alley. Jonas looked a moment longer, then stepped into the rest. Roland was out from behind the carved bear, down the steps and into the street at once. He hadn't Alain's gift of the touch, but he had intuitions that were sometimes very strong. This one was telling him he must hurry. Overhead, the kissing moon drifted behind a cloud. 6. Petty the Trotter still stood on her stool, but she no longer felt drunk, and singing was the last thing on her mind. She could hardly believe what she was seeing. Jonas had the drop on a boy who had the drop on Reynolds, who had the drop on another boy, this last one wearing a bird's skull around his neck on a chain, who had the drop on Roy DePape, who had, in fact, drawn some of Roy DePape's blood. And when Jonas had told the big boy to put down the knife he was holding to Reynolds' throat, the big boy had refused. "You can blow my lights out and send me to the clearing at the end of the path," thought Petty, "for now I've seen it all, so I have." She supposed she should get off the stool. There was apt to be shooting any second now, and likely a great lot of it. But sometimes you just had to take your chances, because some things were just too good to miss. 7. "We're in this town on affiliation business," Alain said. He had one hand buried deep in Reynolds's sweaty hair, the other maintained a steady pressure on the knife at Reynolds's throat, not quite enough to break the skin. "If you harm us, the affiliation will take note. So will our fathers. You'll be hunted like dogs and hung upside down like as not when you're caught."
"Sonny, there's not an affiliation patrol within 200 wheels of here, probably 300, Jonas said, "and I wouldn't care a fart in a windstorm if there was one just over yon hill. Nor do your fathers mean a squitter to me. Put that knife down or I'll blow your fucking brains out."
"No. Future developments in this matter should be quite wonderful," Cuthbert said cheerily, although there was now a beat of nerves under his prattle. Not fear, perhaps not even nervousness, just nerves. The good kind, more likely than not, Jonas thought sourly. He had underestimated these boys at meat. If nothing else was clear, that was. "You shoot Richard?" And Richard cuts Mr. Cloak's throat, just as Mr. Cloak shoots me. My poor dying fingers release my sling's elastic and put a steel ball in what passes for Mr. Spectacle's brain. You'll walk away, at least, and I suppose that'll be a great comfort to your dead friends. "Call it a draw," Alain said to the man with the gun at his temple. "We all stand back and walk away." "No, sonny," Jonas said. His voice was patient, and he didn't think his anger showed, but it was rising. Gods, to be outfaced like this, even temporarily. "No one does like that to the big coffin hunters. This is your last chance to—" Something hard and cold and very much to the point pressed against the back of Jonas's shirt, dead center between the shoulder blades. He knew what it was, and who held it at once, understood the game was lost, but couldn't understand how such a ludicrous, maddening turn of events could have happened. "Holster the gun," the voice behind the sharp tip of metal said. It was empty somehow, not just calm, but emotionless. "Do it now, or this goes in your heart. No more talk. Talking's done. Do it or die." Jonas heard two things in that voice, youth and truth. He holstered his gun. "You with the black hair, take your gun out of my friend's ear and put it back in your holster. Now." Clay Reynolds didn't have to be invited twice, and he uttered a long, shaky sigh when Alain took the blade off his throat and stood back. Cuthbert did not look around, only stood with the elastic of his slingshot pulled and his elbow cocked. "You at the bar?" Roland said. "Holster up." DePape did so, grimacing with pain as he bumped his hurt finger against his gun belt. Only when this gun was put away did Cuthbert relax his hold on his sling and drop the ball from the cup into the palm of his hand. The cause of all this had been forgotten as the effects played themselves out. Now Sheamy got to his feet and pelted across the room. His cheeks were wet with tears. He grasped one of Cuthbert's hands, kissed it several times, loud smacking noises that would have been comic under other circumstances, and held the hand to his cheek for a moment. Then he dodged past Reynolds, pushed open the right-hand bat wing, and flew right into the arms of a sleepy-eyed and still half-drunk sheriff. Avery had been fetched by Sheb from the jailhouse, where the sheriff of Barony had been sleeping off the mayor's ceremonial dinner in one of his own cells. 8.
"This is a nice mess, isn't it?"
Avery speaking, no one answering. He hadn't expected they would, not if they knew what was good for them. The office area of the jail was too small to hold three men, three strapping not-quite-men, and one extra-large sheriff comfortably, so Avery had herded them into the nearby town gathering hall, which echoed to the soft flutter of the pigeons in the rafters and the steady beat, beat, beat of the grandfather clock behind the podium. It was a plain room, but an inspired choice all the same. It was where the townsfolk and barony landowners had come for hundreds of years to make their decisions, pass their laws, and occasionally send some especially troublesome person west. There was a feeling of seriousness in its moon-glimmered darkness, and Roland thought even the old man Jonas felt a little of it. Certainly it invested Sheriff Herc Avery with an authority he might not otherwise have been able to project. The room was filled with what were in that place and time called bareback benches, oaken pews with no cushions for either butt or back. There were 60 in all, 30 on each side of a wide center aisle. Jonas, DePape, and Reynolds sat on the front bench to the left of the aisle. Roland, Cuthbert, and Alain sat across from them on the right. Reynolds and DePape looked sullen and embarrassed. Jonas looked remote and composed. Will Dearborn's little crew was quiet. Roland had given Cuthbert a look which he hoped the boy could read. "One smart remark, and I'll rip the tongue right out of your head." He thought the message had been received. Bert had stowed his idiotic lookout somewhere, which was a good sign.
"A nice mess," Avery repeated, and blew liquor-scented wind at them in a deep sigh.
He was sitting on the edge of the stage with his short legs hanging down, looking at them with a kind of disgusted wonder. The side door opened, and in came Deputy Dave, his white service jacket laid aside, his monocle tucked into the pocket of his more usual khaki shirt. In one hand he carried a mug, in the other a folded scrap of what looked to Roland like birch bark.
"Did ye boil the first half, David?"
Avery asked. He now wore a put-upon expression.
"Aye. Boiled it twice?"
"Aye, twice. For that was the directions."
"Aye,"
Dave repeated in a resigned voice. He handed Avery the cup and dumped the remaining contents of the birch bark scrap in when the sheriff held the cup out for them. Avery swirled the liquid, peered in with a doubtful, resigned expression, then drank. He grimaced.
"Oh, foul!" he cried. "What's so nasty as this?"
"What is it?" Jonas asked.
"Headache powder? Hangover powder, you might say. From the old witch, the one who lives up the Coos. Know where I mean?"
Avery gave Jonas a knowing look. The old gunny pretended not to see it, but Roland thought he had. And what did it mean? Another mystery. DePape looked up at the word Coos, then went back to sucking his wounded finger. Beyond DePape, Reynolds sat with his cloak drawn about him, looking grimly down at his lap. "Does it work?" Roland asked.
"Aye, boy, but you pay a price for witch's medicine. Remember that. You always pay. This one takes away the headache if you drink too much of Mayor Thorne's Dan Punch, but it gripes the bowels something fierce, so it does. And the farts!"
He waved a hand in front of his face to demonstrate, took another sip from the cup, then set it aside. He returned to his former gravity, but the mood in the room had lightened just a little. They all felt it.
"Now, what are we to do about this business?"
Herc Avery swept them slowly with his eyes, from Reynolds on his far right to Alain Richard Stockworth on his far left.
"Hey, boys, we've got the mayor's men on one side and the affiliations, men on the other. Six fellas at the point of murder. And over what? A half-wit and a spilled bucket of slops."
He pointed first at the big coffin hunters, then to the affiliation's counters.
"Two powder kegs and one fat sheriff in the middle. So what's your thoughts on't? Speak up, don't be shy. You wasn't shy in Coral's whore den down the road, don't be shy in here."
No one said anything. Avery sipped some more of his foul drink, then set it down and looked at them decisively. What he said next didn't surprise Roland much. It was exactly what he would have expected of a man like Avery, right down to the tone which implied that he considered himself a man who could make the hard decisions when he had to, by the gods.
"I'll tell yer what we're going to do. We're going to forget it."
He now assumed the air of one who expects an uproar and is prepared to handle it. When no one spoke or even shuffled a foot, he looked discomfited. Yet he had a job to do, and the night was growing old. He squared his shoulders and pushed on.
"I'll not spend the next 3 or 4 months waiting to see who among you's killed who. Nay, nor will I be put in a position where I might have to take the punishment for your stupid quarrel over that half-wit shimmy. I appeal to your practical natures, boys, when I point out that I may be either your friend or your enemy during your time here. But I'd be wrong if I didn't also appeal to your more noble natures, which I am sure are both large and sensitive."
The sheriff now tried on an exalted expression, which was not, in Roland's estimation, notably successful. Avery turned his attention to Jonas.
"Sigh? I can't believe ye'll want to be causing trouble for 3 young men from the affiliation. The affiliation that's been like mother's milk and father's sheltering hand since I or oh 50 generations back. Ye'd not be so disrespectful as all that, would ye?"
Jonas shook his head, smiling his thin smile. Avery nodded again. Things were going along well, that nod said.
"Ye have all your own cakes to bake and oats to roll, and none of ye want something like this to get in the way of doing your jobs, do yer?"
They all shook their heads this time.
"So what I want ye to do is to stand up, face each other, shake hands, and cry each other's pardon. If you don't do that, you can all ride west out of town by sunrise, as far as I'm concerned."
He picked up the mug and took a bigger drink this time. Roland saw that the man's hand was trembling the tiniest bit, and wasn't surprised. It was all bluff and blow, of course. The sheriff would have understood that Jonas, Reynolds, and DePape were beyond his authority as soon as he saw the small blue coffins on their hands. After tonight, he must feel the same way about Dearborn, Stockworth, and Heath. He could only hope that all would see where their self-interest lay. Roland did. So apparently did Jonas, for even as Roland got up, Jonas did the same. Avery recoiled a little bit, as if expecting Jonas to go for his gun and Dearborn for the knife in his belt, the one he'd been holding against Jonas's back when Avery came puffing up to the saloon. There was no gun or knife drawn, however. Jonas turned toward Roland and held out his hand. "He's right, lad," Jonas said in his reedy, quavering voice. "Yes. Will you shake with an old man and vow to start over?" "Yes." Roland held out his hand. Jonas took it. "I cry your pardon." "I cry your own, Mr. Jonas." Roland tapped left hand at his throat, as was proper when addressing an elder in such fashion. As the two of them sat down, Alain and Reynolds rose, as neatly as men in a pre-rehearsed ceremony. Last of all, Cuthbert and DePape rose. Roland was all but positive that Cuthbert's foolishness would pop out like Jack from his box. The idiot would simply not be able to help himself, although he must surely realize that DePape was no man to make sport of tonight. "Cry your pardon," Bert said, with an admirable lack of laughter in his voice. "Cry your own," DePape mumbled and held out his blood-streaked hand. Roland had a nightmare vision of Bert squeezing down on it as hard as he could, making the redhead yowl like an owl on a hot stove, but Bert's grip was as restrained as his voice. Avery sat on the edge of the stage with his pudgy legs hanging down, watching it all with avuncular good cheer. Even Deputy Dave was smiling. "Now I propose to shake hands with yer all myself, and then send yer on your ways, for the hour's late, so it is, and such as me needs my beauty rest." He chuckled, and again looked uncomfortable, and no one joined in. But he slipped off the stage and began to shake hands, doing so with the enthusiasm of a minister who has finally succeeded in marrying a headstrong couple after a long and stormy courtship. 9. When they stepped outside, the moon was down, and the first lightning in the sky had begun to show at the far edge of the clean sea.
"Mayhap we'll meet again, Si," Jonas said.
"Mayhap we will," Roland said, and swung up into his saddle. 10. The big coffin hunters were staying in the watchman's house about a mile south of Seafront, 5 miles out of town this was. Halfway there, Jonas stopped at a turnout beside the road. From here the land made a steep, rocky descent to the brightening sea.
"Get down, mister," he said.
It was DePape he was looking at.
Jonas, I get down."
Biting his lip nervously, DePape got down.
"Take off your spectacles. Jonas, what's this about? I don't, or if you want 'em broke, leave 'em on. It's all the same to me."
Biting his lip harder now, DePape took off his gold-rimmed spectacles. They were barely in his hand before Jonas had fetched him a terrific clip on the side of the head. DePape cried out and reeled toward the drop. Jonas drove forward, moving as fast as he had struck, and seized him by the shirt just before he went tumbling over the edge. Jonas twisted his hand into the shirt material and yanked DePape toward him. He breathed deep, inhaling the scent of pine tar and DePape's sweat.
"I ought to toss you right over the edge," he breathed. "Do you know how much harm you've done?"
Jonas, I never meant... Just a little fun is all I... How is we supposed to know they...
Slowly, Jonas's hand relaxed. That last bit of babble had gone home. How was they supposed to know? That was ungrammatical, but right. And if not for tonight, they might not have known. If you looked at it that way, DePape had actually done them a favor. The devil you knew was always preferable to the devil you didn't. Still, word would get around, and people would laugh. Maybe even that was all right, though. The laughter would stop in due time.
"Jonas, I cry your pardon."
"Shut up," Jonas said. In the east, the sun would shortly heave itself over the horizon, casting its first gleams on a new day in this world of toil and sorrow.
"I ain't going to toss you over, because then I'd have to toss Clay over and follow along myself. They got the drop on us the same as you, right?"
DePape wanted to agree, but thought it might be dangerous to do so. He was prudently silent.
"Get down here, Clay."
Clay slid off his mount.
"Now hunker."
The three of them hunkered on their boot soles, heels up. Jonas plucked a shoot of grass and put it between his lips.
"Affiliation brats is what we were told, and we had no reason not to believe it," he said. "The bad boys are sent all the way to Magus, a sleepy barony on the clean sea, on a make-work detail that's 2 parts penance and 3 parts punishment. Ain't that what we were told?"
They nodded.
"Either of you believe it after tonight?"
DePape shook his head. So did Clay.
"They may be rich boys, but that's not all they are," DePape said. "The way they were tonight, they were like..."
He trailed off, not quite willing to finish the thought. It was too absurd. Jonas was willing.
"They acted like gunslingers."
Neither Jonas nor Reynolds replied at first. Then Clay Reynolds said,
"They're too young, Eldred. Too young by years." "Not too young to be prentices, mayhap. In any case, we're going to find out."
He turned to DePape.
"You've got some riding to do, Cully." "Oh, Jonas, none of us exactly covered ourselves with glory, but you were the fool that started the pot boiling."
He looked at DePape, but DePape only looked down at the ground between them.
"You're going to ride their back trail, Roy, and you're going to ask questions until you got the answers you think will satisfy my curiosity. Clay and I are mostly going to wait and watch, play castles with them if you like. When I feel like enough time's gone by for us to be able to do a little snooping without being trigged, mayhap we'll do it."
He bit on the piece of grass in his mouth. The larger piece tumbled out and lay between his boots.
"Do you know why I shook his hand, that boy Dearborn's damned hand? Because we can't rock the boat, boys, not just when it's edging in toward harbor. Latigo and the folks we've been waiting for will be moving toward us very soon now. Until they get into these parts, it's in our interest to keep the peace. But I tell you this, no one puts a knife to Eldred Jonas's back and lives. Now listen, Roy, don't make me tell you any of this twice."
Jonas began to speak, leaning forward over his knees toward DePape as he did. After a while, DePape began to nod. He might like a little trip, actually. After the recent comedy and the Traveler's Rest, a change of air might be just the ticket. 11. The boys were almost back to the bar K, and the sun was coming over the horizon before Cuthbert broke the silence. "Well, that was an amusing and instructive evening, was it not?" Neither Roland nor Alain replied, so Cuthbert leaned over to the rook's skull, which he had returned to its former place on the horn of his saddle. "What say you, old friend? Did we enjoy our evening? Dinner, a circle dance, and almost killed to top things off. Did you enjoy?" The lookout only stared ahead of Cuthbert's horse with its great dark eyes. "He says he's too tired for talk," Cuthbert said, then yawned. "So am I, actually." He looked at Roland. "I got a good look into Mr. Jonas's eyes after he shook hands with you, Will. He means to kill you." Roland nodded. "They mean to kill all of us," Alain said. Roland nodded again. "We'll make it hard for them, but they know more about us now than they did at dinner. We'll not get behind them that way again." He stopped, just as Jonas had stopped not 3 miles from where they now were. Only instead of looking directly out over the clean sea, Roland and his friends were looking down the long slope of the drop. a herd of horses was moving from west to east, barely more than shadows in this light. "What do you see, Roland?" Alan asked, almost timidly. "Trouble," Roland said. "And in our road." Then he gigged his horse and rode on. Before they got back to the Barcade bunkhouse, he was thinking about Susan again. 5 minutes after he dropped his head on his flat burlap pillow, he was dreaming of her. Chapter 7 On the Drop 1 3 weeks had passed since the welcoming dinner at Mayor's house and the incident at the Traveler's Rest. There had been no more trouble between Roland's quartet and Jonas's. In the night sky, Kissing Moon had waned, and Peddler's Moon had made its first thin appearance. The days were bright and warm. Even the old-timers admitted it was one of the most beautiful summers in memory. On a mid-morning as beautiful as any that summer, Susan Delgado galloped a 2-year-old Rocio named Pylon north along the drop. The wind dried the tears on her cheeks and yanked her unbound hair out behind her as she went. She urged Pylon to go faster yet, lightly thumping his sides with her spurless boots. Pylon turned it up a notch at once, ears flattening, tail flagging. Susan, dressed in jeans and a faded, oversized khaki shirt, one of her dads that had caused all the trouble, leaned over the light practice saddle, holding to the horn with one hand and rubbing the other down the side of the horse's strong, silky neck.
"More," she whispered. "More and faster. Go on, boy."
Pylon let it out yet another notch. That he had at least one more in him, she knew. That he had even one more beyond that, she suspected. They sped along the drop's highest ridge, and she barely saw the magnificent slope of land below her, all green and gold, or the way it faded into the blue haze of the clean sea. On any other day, the view and the cool, salt-smelling breeze would have uplifted her. Today she only wanted to hear the steady, low thunder of Pylon's hoofs and feel the flex of his muscles beneath her. Today she wanted to outrun her own thoughts. And all because she had come downstairs this morning dressed for riding in one of her father's old shirts. 2 Aunt Cord had been at the stove, wrapped in her dressing gown and with her hair still netted. She dished herself up a bowl of oatmeal and brought it to the table. Susan had known things weren't good as soon as her aunt turned toward her, bowl in hand. She could see the discontented twitch of Aunt Cord's lips and the disapproving glance she shot at the orange Susan was peeling. Her aunt was still rankled by the silver and gold she had expected to have in hand by now, coins which would be withheld yet a while due to the witch's prankish decree that Susan should remain a virgin until autumn. But that wasn't the main thing, and Susan knew it. Quite simply put, the two of them had had enough of each other. The money was only one of Aunt Cord's disappointed expectations. She had counted on having the house at the edge of the drop to herself this summer, except perhaps for the occasional visit from Mr. Eldred Jonas, with whom Cordelia seemed quite taken. Instead, here they still were, one woman growing toward the end of her courses, thin, disapproving lips in a thin, disapproving face, tiny apple breasts under her high-neck dresses with their choker collars, the neck, she frequently told Susan, is the first thing to go, her hair losing its former chestnut shine and showing wire threads of gray. The other, young, intelligent, agile, and rounding toward the peak of her physical beauty. They grated against each other, each word seeming to produce a spark, and that was not surprising. The man who had loved them both enough to make them love each other was gone. "Are you going out on that horse?" Aunt Cord had said, putting her bowl down and sitting in a shaft of early sun. It was a bad location, one she never would have allowed herself to be caught in had Mr. Jonas been in attendance. The strong light made her face look like a carved mask. There was a cold sore growing at one corner of her mouth. She always got them when she was not sleeping well. "Aye," Susan said. "You should eat more than that, then. 'Twon't keep you till 9 o'clock, girl." "It'll keep me fine," Susan had replied, eating the sections of orange faster. She could see where this was tending, could see the look of dislike and disapproval in her aunt's eyes, and wanted to get away from the table before trouble could begin.
"Why not let me get ye a dish of this?"
Aunt Cord asked, and plopped her spoon into her oatmeal. To Susan it sounded like a horse's hoof stamping down in mud, or shit, and her stomach clenched.
"It'll hold you to lunch if you plan to ride so long. I suppose a fine young lady such as yourself can't be bothered with chores."
"They're done. And you know they're done," she did not add. "I did them while you were sitting before your glass, poking at that sore on your mouth." Aunt Cord dropped a chunk of creamery butter into her muck. Susan had no idea how the woman stayed so thin, really she didn't, and watched it begin to melt. For a moment it seemed that breakfast might end on a reasonably civilized note after all. Then the shirt business had begun.
"Before you go out, Susan, I want you to take off that rag you're wearing and put on one of the new riding blouses Thorin sent you week before last. It's the least you can do to show your—"
Anything her aunt might have said past that point would have been lost in anger, even if Susan hadn't interrupted. She passed a hand down the sleeve of her shirt, loving its texture. It was almost velvety from so many washings.
"This rag belonged to my father."
"Aye, Pat's,"
Aunt Cord sniffed.
"It's too big for ye, and worn out, and not proper in any case. When you were young it was mayhap all right to wear a man's button shirt, but now that ye have a woman's bust line—"
The riding blouses were on hangers in the corner. They had come 4 days ago, and Susan hadn't even deigned to take them up to her room. There were three of them. One red, one green, one blue, all silk, all undoubtedly worth a small fortune. She loathed their pretension and the overblown, blushy, frilly look of them, full sleeves to flutter artistically in the wind, great floppy, foolish collars, and, of course, the low-scooped fronts, which were probably all Thorin would see if she appeared before him dressed in one, as she wouldn't if she could possibly help it.
"My woman's bust line, as you call it, is of no interest to me, and can't possibly be of any interest to anyone else when I'm out riding,"
Susan said.
"Perhaps, perhaps not. If one of the barony's drovers should see you, even Rennie, he's out that way all the time, as you well know, it wouldn't hurt for him to mention to Hart that he saw your wearing one of the camisas that he so kindly gave to you, now would it? Why do you have to be such a stiffkins, girl? Why always so unwilling, so unfair?"
"What does it matter to you one way or t'other?" Susan had asked.
"You have the money, don't you? And you'll have more yet, after he fucks me."
Aunt Cord, her face white and shocked and furious, had leaned across the table and slapped her.
"How dare they use that word in my house, ye malhablada! How dare ye!"
That was when her tears began to flow, at hearing her call it her house.
"It was my father's house, his and mine. Ye were all on your own, with no real place to go, except perhaps to the quarters, and he took ye in. He took ye in, aunt!"
The last two orange sections were still in her hand. She threw them into her aunt's face, then pushed herself back from the table so violently that her chair tottered, tipped, and spilled her to the floor. Her aunt's shadow fell over her. Susan crawled frantically out of it, her hair hanging, her slapped cheek throbbing, her eyes burning with tears, her throat swelled and hot. At last she found her feet.
"Ye ungrateful girl," her aunt said. Her voice was soft and so full of venom it was almost caressing. "After all I have done for thee, and all Hart Thorin has done for thee, why, the very nag ye mean to ride this morning was Hart's gift of respect to Pylon was ours!"
she shrieked, almost maddened with fury at this deliberate blurring of the truth.
"All of them were! The horses, the land, they were ours!"
"Lower thy voice," Aunt Cord said. Susan took a deep breath and tried to find some control. She swept her hair back from her face, revealing the red print of Aunt Cord's hand on her cheek. Cordelia flinched a little at the sight of it.
"My father never would have allowed this," Susan said. "He never would have allowed me to go as Hart Thorin's jilly." Whatever he might have felt about Hart as the mayor or as his patrono, he never would have allowed this. And ye know it. Thee knows it.
Aunt Cord rolled her eyes, then twirled a finger around her ear as if Susan had gone mad.
"They agreed to it yourself, Miss Oh So Young and Pretty. Aye, so you did. And if your girlish megrims now cause ye to want to cry off what's been done..."
"Aye," Susan agreed. "I agreed to the bargain, so I did. After ye had done me about it day and night, after ye had come to me in tears..."
"I never did," Cordelia cried, stung.
"Have you forgotten so quick, Aunt?" "Aye, I suppose, as by tonight you'll have forgotten slapping me at breakfast." "Well, I haven't forgotten. Thee cried, all right. Cried and told me you feared we might be turned off the land, since we had no more legal right to it, that we'd be on the road. Thee wept and said..."
"Stop calling me that!"
Aunt Cord shouted. Nothing on earth maddened her so much as having her own thees and thous turned back at her.
"Thee has no more right to the old tongue than thee has to thy stupid sheep's complaints. Go on, get out!"
But Susan went on. Her rage was at the flood and would not be turned aside.
"Thee wept and said we'd be turned out, turned west, that we'd never see my dad's homestead or Hambry again. And then when I was frightened enough, he talked of the cunning little baby I'd have, the lamb that was ours to begin with given back again, the horses that were ours likewise given back. As a sign of the mayor's honesty, I have a horse I myself helped to foal. And what have I done to deserve these things that would have been mine in any case but for the loss of a single paper? What have I done so that he should give ye money? What have I done save promise to fuck him while his wife of 40 years sleeps down the hall?"
"Is it the money you want, then?"
Aunt Cord asked, smiling furiously.
Do ye and I? Ye shall have it, then. Take it, keep it, lose it, feed it to the swine. I care not."
She turned to her purse, which hung on a post by the stove. She began to fumble in it, but her motions quickly lost speed and conviction. There was an oval of mirror mounted to the left of the kitchen doorway, and in it Susan caught sight of her aunt's face. What she saw there, a mixture of hatred, dismay, and greed, made her heart sink.
"Never mind, Aunt. I see these loath to give it up, and I wouldn't have it anyway. It's whore's money."
Aunt Cord turned back to her, face shocked, her purse conveniently forgotten.
"'Tis not whoring, you stupid get. Why, some of the greatest women in history have been jillies, and some of the greatest men have been born of jillies. 'Tis not whoring."
Susan ripped the red silk blouse from where it hung and held it up. The shirt molded itself to her breasts as if it had been longing all the while to touch them.
"Then why does he send me these whore's clothes?"
"Susan!"
Tears stood in Aunt Cord's eyes. Susan flung the shirt at her as she had the orange slices. It landed on her shoes.
"Pick it up and put it on yourself, if you fancy. You spread your legs for him, if you fancy."
She turned and hurled herself out the door. Her aunt's half-hysterical shriek had followed her.
"Don't thee go off thinking foolish thoughts, Susan. Foolish thoughts lead to foolish deeds, and it's too late for either. Thee's agreed."
She knew that. And however fast she rode Pylon along the drop, she could not outrace her knowing. She had agreed. And no matter how horrified Pat Delgado might have been at the fix she had gotten herself into, he would have seen one thing clear. She had made a promise, and promises must be kept. Hell awaited those who would not do so. 3. She eased the Rocio back while he still had plenty of wind. She looked behind her, saw that she had come nearly a mile, and brought him down further, to a canter, a trot, a fast walk. She took a deep breath and let it out. For the first time that morning, she registered the day's bright beauty, gulls circling in the hazy air off to the west, high grasses all around her, and flowers in every shaded cranny, cornflowers and lupin and phlox, and her favorites, the delicate blue silk flowers. From everywhere came the somnolent buzz of bees. The sound soothed her, and with the high surge of her emotions subsiding a little, she was able to admit something to herself. Admit it,
and then voice it aloud. "Will Dearborn," she said, and shivered at the sound of his name on her lips, even though there was no one to hear it but Pylon and the bees. So she said it again. And when the words were out, she abruptly turned her own wrist inward to her mouth and kissed it where the blood beat close to the surface. The action shocked her because she hadn't known she was going to do it, and shocked her more because the taste of her own skin and sweat aroused her immediately. She felt an urge to cool herself off, as she had in her bed after meeting him. The way she felt, it would be short work. Instead, she growled her father's favorite cuss, "Oh, bite it," and spat past her boot. Will Dearborn had been responsible for all too much upset in her life these last 3 weeks. Will Dearborn, with his unsettling blue eyes, his dark tumble of hair, and his stiff-necked, judgmental attitude. "I can be discreet, madam. As for propriety, I'm amazed you even know the word." Every time she thought of that, her blood sang with anger and shame. Mostly anger. How dare he presume to make judgments? He who had grown up possessing every luxury, no doubt with servants to tend his every whim, and so much gold that he likely didn't even need it. He would be given the things he wanted, free, as a way of currying favor. What would a boy like that, for that was all he was, really, just a boy, know about the hard choices she had made? For that matter, how could such as Mr. Will Dearborn of Hemphill understand that she hadn't really made those choices at all? That she had been carried to them, the way a mother cat carries a wayward kitten back to the nesting box, by the scruff of the neck. Still, he wouldn't leave her mind. She knew, even if Aunt Cord didn't, that there had been an unseen third present at their quarrel this morning. She knew something else as well, something that would have upset her aunt to no end. Will Dearborn hadn't forgotten her, either. 4. About a week after the welcoming dinner and Dearborn's disastrous, hurtful remark to her, the retarded slops fellow from the Traveler's Rest, Sheemy, folks called him, had appeared at the house Susan and her aunt shared. In his hands he held a large bouquet, mostly made up of the wildflowers that grew out on the drop, but with a scattering of dusky wild roses as well. They looked like pink punctuation marks. On the boy's face there had been a wide, sunny grin as he swung the gate open, not waiting for an invitation. Susan had been sweeping the front walk at the time. Aunt Cord had been out back in the garden. That was fortunate, but not very surprising. These days the two of them got on best when they kept apart as much as they could. Susan had watched Sheemy come up the walk, his grin beaming out from behind his upheld freight of flowers, with a mixture of fascination and horror.
"Good day, Susan Delgado, daughter of Pat," Sheemy said cheerfully. "I come to you on an errand and cry your pardon at any troublation I be. Oh, aye, for I am a problem for folks, and know it same as them. These be for you. Here."
He thrust them out, and she saw a small folded envelope tucked amongst them.
"Susan?"
Aunt Cord's voice from around the side of the house and getting closer.
"Susan, did I hear the gate?"
"Yes, aunt,"
she called back, curse the woman's sharp ears. Susan nimbly plucked the envelope from its place among the phlox and daisies. Into her dress pocket it went.
"They from my third best friend,"
Sheemy said.
"I got 3 different friends now. This many."
He held up 2 fingers, frowned, added 2 more, and then grinned splendidly.
"Arthur Heath, my first best friend. Dick Stockworth, my second best friend. My third best friend..."
"Hush," Susan said, in a low, fierce voice that made Sheemy's smile fade. "Not a word about your 3 friends." A funny little flush, almost like a pocket fever, raced across her skin. It seemed to run down her neck from her cheeks, then slip all the way to her feet. There had been a lot of talk in Hambry about Sheemy's new friends during the past week. Talk about little else, it seemed. The stories she had heard were outlandish. But if they weren't true, why did the versions told by so many different witnesses sound so much alike?
Susan was still trying to get herself back under control when Aunt Cord swept around the corner. Shimi fell back a step at the sight of her, puzzlement becoming outright dismay. Her aunt was allergic to bee stings and was presently swaddled from the top of her straw brera to the hem of her faded garden dress in gauzy stuff that made her look peculiar in strong light and downright eerie in shade. Adding a final touch to her costume, she carried a pair of dirt-streaked garden shears in one gloved hand. She saw the bouquet and bore down on it, shears raised. When she reached her niece, she slid the scissors into a loop on her belt, almost reluctantly, it seemed to the niece herself, and parted the veil on her face.
"Who sent ye those?"
"I don't know, Aunt," Susan said, much more calmly than she felt.
"This is the young man from the inn."
"Inn?" Aunt Cord snorted.
"He doesn't seem to know who sent him,"
Susan carried on. "If only she could get him out of here."
"He's... well, I suppose you'd say he's..."
"He's a fool, yes, I know that."
Aunt Cord cast Susan a brief, irritated look, then bent her attention on Shimi. Talking with her gloved hands upon her knees, shouting directly into his face, she asked, "Who sent these flowers, young man?" The wings of her face veil, which had been pushed aside, now fell back into place. Shimi took another step backward. He looked frightened.
"Was it, perhaps, someone from Seafront? From Mayor Thorin? Tell me, and I'll give you a penny."
Susan's heart sank. Sure he would tell. He'd not have the wit to understand he'd be getting her into trouble. Will, too, likely. But Shimi only shook his head.
"Don't remember. I got an empty head, Si, so I do. Stanley says I a bug wit."
His grin shone out again, a splendid thing, full of white, even teeth. Aunt Cord answered it with a grimace.
"Oh, foo! Be gone, then. Straight back to town, too. Don't be hanging around hoping for a goose feather. For a boy who can't remember deserves not so much as a penny. And don't you come back here again, no matter who wants you to carry flowers for the young Si. Do you hear me?"
Shimi had nodded energetically. Then,
"Si?"
Aunt Cord glowered at him. The vertical line on her forehead had been very prominent that day.
"Why are you all wrapped up in cobwebby, Si?" "Get out of here, ye impudent cull!"
Aunt Cord cried. She had a good loud voice when she wanted to use it, and Shimi jumped back from her in alarm. When she was sure he was headed back down the high street toward town and had no intention of returning to their gate and hanging about in hopes of a tip, Aunt Cord had turned to Susan.
"Get those in some water before they wilt, Miss Oh-So-Young and Pretty, and don't go mooning about wondering who your secret admirer might be."
Then Aunt Cord had smiled, a real smile. What hurt Susan the most, confused her the most, was that her aunt was no cradle-story ogre, no witch like Rhea of the Coos. There was no monster here, only a maiden lady with some few social pretensions, a love of gold and silver, and a fear of being turned out penniless into the world.
"For folks such as us, Susie Pie," she said, speaking with a terrible, heavy kindness, "'tis best to stick to our housework and leave dreams to them as can afford 'em."
5. She had been sure the flowers were from Will, and she was right. His note was written in a hand which was clear and passing fair. "Dear Susan Delgado, I spoke out of turn the other night, and cry your pardon. May I see you and speak to you? It must be private. This is a matter of importance. If you will see me, get a message to the boy who brings this. He is safe. Will Dearborn." A matter of importance. Underlined. She felt a strong desire to know what was so important to him, and cautioned herself against doing anything foolish. Perhaps he was smitten with her. And if so, whose fault was that? Who had talked to him, ridden his horse, showed him her legs in a flashy carnival dismount? Who had put her hands on his shoulders and kissed him? Her cheeks and forehead burned at the thought of that, and another hot ring seemed to go slipping down her body. She wasn't sure she regretted the kiss, but it had been a mistake, regrets or no regrets. Seeing him again now would be a worse one. Yet she wanted to see him, and knew in her deepest heart that she was ready to set her anger at him aside. But there was the promise she had made. The wretched promise. That night she lay sleepless, tossing about in her bed, first thinking it would be better, more dignified, just to keep her silence, then composing mental notes anyway, some haughty, some cold, some with a lace edge of flirtation. When she heard the midnight bell ring, passing the old day out and calling the new one in, she decided enough was enough. She'd thrown herself from her bed, gone to her door, opened it, and thrust her head out into the hall. When she heard Aunt Cord's flute-like snores, she had closed her door again, crossed to her little desk by the window, and lit her lamp. She took one of her sheets of parchment paper from the top drawer, tore it in half. In Hambry, the only crime greater than wasting paper was wasting threaded stock line, and then wrote quickly, sensing that the slightest hesitation might condemn her to more hours of indecision. With no salutation and no signature, her response took only a breath to write. "I may not see you. 'Twould not be proper." She had folded it small, blew out her lamp, and returned to bed with the note safely tucked under her pillow. She was asleep in 2 minutes. The following day, when the marketing took her to town, she had gone by the Traveler's Rest, which at 11 in the morning had all the charm of something which has died badly at the side of the road. The saloon's dooryard was a beaten dirt square bisected by a long hitching rail with a watering trough beneath. Sheeny was trundling a wheelbarrow along the rail, picking up last night's horse droppings with a shovel. He was wearing a comical pink sombrero and singing Golden Slippers. Susan doubted if many of the rest patrons would wake up feeling as well as Sheeny obviously did this morning. So who, when you came right down to it, was more soft-headed? She looked around to make sure no one was paying heed to her, then went over to Sheeny and tapped him on the shoulder. He looked frightened at first, and Susan didn't blame him. According to the story she'd been hearing, Jonas's friend DePape had almost killed the poor kid for spilling a drink on his boots. Then Sheeny recognized her.
"Hello, Susan Delgado from out there by the edge of town," he said companionably. "It's a good day, I wish you, Si."
He bowed, an amusing imitation of the inner barony's bow favored by his three new friends. Smiling, she dropped him a bit of a curtsy. Wearing jeans, she had to pretend at the skirt-holding part, but women in Magus got used to curtsying in pretend skirts.
"See my flowers, Si?"
he asked, and pointed toward the unpainted side of the rest. What she saw touched her deeply, a line of mixed blue and white silk flowers growing along the base of the building. They looked both brave and pathetic, flurrying there in the faint morning breeze, with the bald, turd-littered yard before them and the splintery public house behind them.
"Did you grow those, Sheeny?" "Aye, so I did, and Mr. Arthur Heath of Gilead has promised me yellow ones."
"I've never seen yellow silk flowers."
"No, we know, me neither, but Mr. Arthur Heath says they have 'em in Gilead."
He looked at Susan solemnly, the shovel held in his hands as a soldier would hold a gun or spear at port arms.
"Mr. Arthur, he saved my life. I'd do anything for him."
"Would you, Sheeny?" she asked, touched.
"Also, he has a lookout. It's a bird's head, and when he talks to it, tendy pretend, do I laugh? I fit to split."
She looked around again to make sure no one was watching, save for the carved totems across the street, then removed her note, folded small, from her jeans pocket.
"Would you give this to Mr. Dearborn for me? He's also your friend, is he not?" "Well, aye."
He took the note and put it carefully into his own pocket.
"And tell no one."
"Shh," he agreed, and put a finger to his lips. His eyes had been amusingly round beneath the ridiculous pink lady's straw he wore.
"Like when I brought you the flowers. Hushaboo."
"That's right. Hushaboo. Fare ye well, Sheeny."
"And you, Susan Delgado."
He went back to his clean-up operations. Susan had stood watching him for a moment, feeling uneasy and out of sorts with herself. Now that the note was successfully passed, she felt an urge to ask Sheemy to give it back, to scratch out what she had written and promise to meet him. If only to see his steady blue eyes again, looking into her face. Then Jonas's other friend, the one with the cloak, came sauntering out of the mercantile. She was sure he didn't see her. His head was down, and he was rolling a cigarette, but she had no intention of pressing her luck. Reynolds talked to Jonas, and Jonas talked, all too much, to Aunt Cord. If Aunt Cord heard she had been passing the time of day with the boy who had brought her the flowers, there were apt to be questions, ones she didn't want to answer. 6. All that's history now, Susan. Water under the bridge. Best to get your thoughts out of the past. She brought Pylon to a stop and looked down the length of the drop at the horses that moved and grazed there. Quite a surprising number of them this morning. It wasn't working. Her mind kept turning back to Will Dearborn. What bad luck meeting him had been. If not for that chance encounter on her way back down from the Coos, she might well have made peace with her situation by now. She was a practical girl, after all, and a promise was a promise. She certainly never would have expected herself to get all goosey-gushy over losing her maidenhead, and the prospect of carrying and bearing a child actually excited her. But Will Dearborn had changed things, had gotten into her head and now lodged there, a tenant who defied eviction. His remark to her as they danced stayed with her like a song you can't stop humming, even though you hate it. It had been cruel and stupidly self-righteous, that remark. But was there not also a grain of truth in it? Rhea had been right about Hartthorne, of that much Susan no longer had any doubt. She supposed that witches were right about men's lusts even when they were wrong about everything else. Not a happy thought, but likely a true one. It was Will be damned to you, Dearborn, who had made it difficult for her to accept what needed accepting, who had goaded her into arguments in which she could hardly recognize her own shrill and desperate voice, who came to her in her dreams, dreams where he put his arms around her waist and kissed her, kissed her, kissed her. She dismounted and walked downhill a little way with the reins looped in her fist. Pylon followed, willingly enough. And when she stopped to look off into the blue haze to the southwest, he lowered his head and began to crop again. She thought she needed to see Will Dearborn once more, if only to give her innate practicality a chance to reassert itself. She needed to see him at his right size, instead of the one her mind had created for him in her warm thoughts and warmer dreams. Once that was done, she could get on with her life and do what needed doing. Perhaps that was why she had taken this path, the same one she'd ridden yesterday, and the day before yesterday, and the day before that. He rode this part of the drop. That much she had heard in the lower market. She turned away from the drop, suddenly knowing he would be there, as if her thought had called him, or her car. She saw only blue sky and low ridgeline hills that curved gently like the line of a woman's thigh and hip and waist as she lies on her side in bed. Susan felt a bitter disappointment fill her. She could almost taste it in her mouth, like wet tea leaves. She started back to Pylon, meaning to return to the house and take care of the apology she reckoned she must make. The sooner she did it, the sooner it would be done. She reached for her left stirrup, which was twisted a little, and as she did, a rider came over the horizon, breaking against the sky at the place which looked to her like a woman's hip. He sat there, only a silhouette on horseback, but she knew who it was at once.
"Run!" she told herself in a sudden panic. "Mount and gallop! Get out of here, quickly, before something terrible happens, before it really is, Ka, come like a wind to take you and all your plans over the sky and far away."
She didn't run.
She stood with Pylon's reins in one hand and murmured to him when the Rocio looked up and nickered a greeting to the big bay-colored gelding coming down the hill. Then Will was there, first above her and looking down, then dismounted in an easy, liquid motion she didn't think she could have matched for all her years of horsemanship. This time there was no kicked-out leg and planted heel, no hat swept over a comically solemn bow. This time the gaze he gave her was steady and serious and disquietingly adult. They looked at each other in the drop's big silence, Roland of Gilead and Susan of Magus, and in her heart she felt a wind begin to blow. She feared it and welcomed it in equal measure. Seven. "Good morn, Susan," he said. "I'm glad to see you again." She said nothing, waiting and watching. Could he hear her heart beating as clearly as she could? Of course not. That was just so much romantic twaddle. Yet it still seemed to her that everything within a 50-yard radius should be able to hear that thumping. Will took a step forward. She took a step back, looking at him mistrustfully. He lowered his head for a moment, then looked up again, his lips set. "I cry your pardon," he said.
"Do you?"
Her voice was cool. "What I said that night was unwarranted." At that she felt a spark of real anger.
"I care not that it was unwarranted. I care that it was unfair, that it hurt